Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Andrew, you know, we didn't get to talk about this last week, but last week UEFA had a leaked proposal about how the semi-finals would, and final would be done away with. And what we would have in its stead would be like this week-long festival of football based on what we saw during the pandemic. Nobody wants that after this week. Nobody.
Are there people just sitting in a room somewhere thinking of ways to change this? Why? Find something else to do. Redirect your resources. It's perfect. It's perfect.
I tweeted that they need, the European Union need to slap a protection order on the Champions League. So, like, you know, one of those old buildings you walk around in foreign cities or even in New York, and it's got this big plate on it and someone famous was born there, or it's the same. There's a merchant house on the Lower East Side across from the
Swift. Oh, yeah. I saw them everywhere growing up in Philadelphia. They were all over the place.
Yeah. And you can't touch them. Like, no planning permission can come in, except for essential like repairs to keep them standing up. Otherwise, you're not allowed to mess with them. That's the Champions League. Champions League is an old brownstone in which Edgar Allan Poe watched his first Champions League game, and therefore we can never touch it.
I'm so excited about everything that's gone on over the past few days. When I was in college, my friends and I, we created like a club, an unofficial club at Syracuse.
I bet you did.
It was very unofficial, but there was just a group of us that love, like, a lot of my friends there just happened to also love soccer in a time when soccer was definitely growing and like the U.S. men and women were big, but like European club soccer was still kind of like getting off the ground a little bit. FIFA was in its real prime. So it was, you could see it building. Fox Soccer Channel helped. But so we created a club called.
And sorry to cut across, Andrew. Yeah. The club was, I mean, you can just say it. You can just say it. Was the Communist Party. So.
No, but we lived in a section of the university called South Campus. And so we would tape the games, Champions League games that were on during the day. We would all avoid the scores during the day. And then we would all come together at night and watch it. And it was like a really fun thing to do midweek when you're kind of like Wednesday. It's like Tuesday, Wednesday of the school week. It's like you're trying to look forward to the weekend. We had this thing. And so we called it the SCCLC, the South Campus Champions League Club. And I was so excited about everything that's going on. You can't see me, JJ, but we had jerseys made. And I'm wearing mine today.
Wow.
Proudly.
That's very cool. I have to say, I that commitment is pretty great. You
absolutely
know, and it's a great time, you know, a great use of the time you should have been using to, you know, meet girls. And
well, I was dating. I was with my now wife. We were dating in college.
Yeah.
How dare you, trying to get me to like be promiscuous outside of a relationship. I'm a monogamous man, JJ, all right? Let's talk now. There's so much. I do know where to begin. First off, I want to say congrats to you for Liverpool being back in the Champions League final for the third time in 5 years. You are living in quite a moment, my friend. This era just continues to get better and better. We'll talk more about the Liverpool match after the first break, but I just at least wanted to get that out of the way. I don't want to bury that. So much of this podcast kind of revolves around our fandom, and I know if Tottenham were in this, I'd be screaming right now. So I can't let that go unsaid in the first few minutes of this podcast. Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you very much. I always feel weird getting congratulated for something I had nothing to do with.
No, but that's not how it is on the show. You know that we take our fanship very seriously.
We do, and look, what you said is absolutely right. To quote a better commentator than me, drink it in. It doesn't happen that regularly, although it has been regular under Klopp, but you know it's cyclical and you just can't take for granted these great moments. So just appreciate them. And I know it's a cliche, but the one game at a time thing is really, really the way to absorb football when you're as good as Liverpool are right now. Just every game means something. Go into it, the thrills, the spills, and just... yeah, drink it all in. There's it's so good because I remember when this time of year for Liverpool fans mostly under Brendan Rodgers and the managers we've had before that, was all about transfers. And it'll be better next year when we get X or Y in, or when we sign him, or just, it's so lovely to be at the business end of a season with football to talk about, other than just like grim transfer scrolling.
Right, off-season preview stuff. You know, there's always next year type stuff.
Yeah, and when I read Manchester United stuff right now, that's the feeling I get.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Right. Thank God.
Yeah, Liverpool were not, it wasn't that long ago that they were there. And I'm sure United at some point in the not-so-distant future will be back in a similar position. It is cyclical, like you said. It's not cyclical for Real Madrid. They seemingly are always here. They find different routes, sometimes a little more circuitous and scenic than others, as was the case on Wednesday at the Bernabeu. This was the stuff of legend. I almost don't even know where to begin with this. Obviously, there's a huge chunk on the Manchester City side that we'll get to, but I like to start with the positives, JJ, and that is, of course, the Real Madrid side, as this was, you know, for a club that has a long history of unbelievable moments, this one is not far from the top, and that is truly saying something.
This was utterly, utterly stunning. It was the most amazing finish to a game that had been puttering along pretty much exactly as Manchester City wanted. I know they've surprised us throughout this competition, throughout this run, PSG, Chelsea. I understand that, but this was, even by their standards, a bolt from beyond. It was so incredible what they did, how they kind of just woke up in those last minutes and did what they did in extra time too. Just truly, truly stunning. And it is the stuff of legend. And I know Real Madrid, more than most clubs, has a lot of legend in its past. So it has a lot of comparison. But to me, just the context of this game, the context of the comeback, the context of how short a window they had to do it in, makes this, it's the best I've ever seen from Real Madrid. And we talked about the Champions Leagues that were won in under Zinedine Zidane, and how they weren't even the best team in their own country that time. And they certainly weren't the best team in a lot of those ties. But with Ronaldo and the players that they had, they found a way. But this, to me, is on a higher plane or level than that. It was truly, truly amazing.
It really was. And you talk about the different contexts in which this occurred. The context of the amount of time that was remaining. Obviously, it's a semifinal. But I think, too, you know, the club that they did it against. You know, we largely look at Manchester City as the best team in the world. And, you know, for them to be holding a lead of that nature late on, it's not something you think can happen. Now, maybe we should know better, because we've seen other great teams, Liverpool and Barcelona, Barcelona to PSG. We've seen great teams blow leads, so it can be done. But I think just something about watching it happen to a Pep side as it did here, it was extremely jarring. Let's go back, and I guess obviously there were, you know, three truly memorable moments, the three goals scored by Real Madrid. But I think the second one in particular was the one where everyone watching this game sort of their eyes popped out of their head and they thought, what exactly am I witnessing here? Here was Peter Drury on the call.
Carvajal. It's Carvajal's cross. Rodrigo! Oh, extraordinary! They prayed for miracles, and miracles arrived! Real Madrid, the team of dreams!
Wow.
Incredible. I mean, the stats guys will tell you that, you know, momentum is not something that's quantifiable, but when that ball, from the second that ball hit the net, it was possible City could get back into it, but it never felt like it. They felt like Real Madrid were a truck on top of a steep hill and the handbrake had just been taken off, and there was only going to be one winner. But even when I say that, there was plenty of time for City to get back into this one, but they didn't. Zito at @_Zeets on Twitter, always a good man for knowledge and wisdom and articles about foxes and cats. Man City should know that the first rule of playing Real Madrid is that you can't just hurt them a bit and think it's all right. If you don't completely bury them, they always have a chance of doing some magical The spirit of the Champions League runs in them. I mean, it's hard not to feel any other way about them at this point, that there is something beyond football. They went back to the studio, to the Paramount Plus studio afterwards, and Jamie Carragher, in fairness to him, he held and stuck to his guns that Real Madrid, he said, Real Madrid aren't a better team than Manchester City. They're not. But that doesn't matter. There's some things going on with this club where they are mainlined into the spirit of this competition, as Zeet said. And they can pull themselves out of pretty much any hole. And that's the biggest, deepest hole. I tweeted last night about after Mahrez's goal. I thought, that's it. One goal on the
night. Yeah, I was going to bring that up. From now on, tweet those predictions from your own account.
No, nobody thinks you're tweeting it, so it doesn't reflect on you. And then straight away, the backlash after the Rodrigo goal and the two Rodrigo goals was, this aged well. And I'm like, shut up. Just stop.
You have no idea how many burner accounts I created to tweet that at you.
Well, no, you went around liking the tweet. Mr. I'm afraid to go on Twitter suddenly grew a pair and started liking everything like a little rat. Because you knew you could have a go at me. That is so, that is so you. It's absolutely vintage you. But the point being is that there are levels of comeback. And it's not that Real Madrid don't have good players or they're not a good team or they're not capable of this. I know that. But there was the thinnest window. They hadn't had a shot on target until the 89th minute. This wasn't a dominant, Real Madrid, they've been just on top, knocking on the door. How have they not scored? It wasn't the case. That just wasn't what was happening. There was that header early on from Benzema, from another great cross from Carvajal, who, by the way, is, maybe to more regular La Liga watchers, isn't underrated in terms of the way he whips a ball in. But to me, not enough is said about his deliveries. And Benzema should have done way better with it. He also had a volley that he slashed at as well. It went high and handsome. But generally, Madrid had...
I did want to talk about that a little bit because that is kind of the... Like, those words that you just said there, that they didn't have a shot on target all game until the goal, I've probably heard those words 1,000 times since the game ended. Like, that is... Clearly, this is the narrative, that Real Madrid did this from nothing, which I do understand. But, it's not like Man City were tearing it up either. Real Madrid, between the two teams, you're right. But, I mean, Madrid did have a free header for Benzema. Vinicius had the chance from about 10 yards out that he just skied over the bar. Remember the way the second half started. 5 seconds in, Vinicius should score. He should have scored seconds into the second half. He scores on those opportunities all the time.
But it's like City had 10 shots on target. Real Madrid had 5, Andrew. Those were chances, okay, but they weren't. This wasn't the performance where they were carving City open and just needed to finish.
No, I understand.
I will grant you that if they were going to do anything, it did seem like it was going to be on Vinicius' side. Although I have to give Kyle Walker credit. If you're coming back into a team after a reasonably long-term injury and you're facing Vinicius and to do as well as he did, I thought he kept him under wraps pretty well. But Vinicius did get down the left in the second half in particular and pop one up for Modric, who, I mean, his first touch was actually poor.
He should take it first time. I don't know what he was doing there. I don't know why he even had a first touch. He should have just fired it right off the pass.
I think he was adjusting to the fact that he had a bad first touch and it hopped up. And that got blocked. And I honestly think that's a better chance. If that stays on the deck, the position Modric was in, you expect him to hit the target. But what I'm saying is, they were at home chasing a goal deficit. They go two goals behind. It's the 89th minute. Like, this is curtains. This is usually curtains, and it really.
It wasn't. It was not this time. Two other things, just to go back to what we were just saying there about the tenor of the game. I saw this stat from ESPN Stats and Info, and I thought it was interesting. Through 80 minutes of the game, there was a combined 1.20 expected goals for the two teams, 0.75 for Real Madrid and 0.45 for Manchester City.
tells you that it wasn't really, it was nothing compared to the first leg in terms of its.
Well, certainly, but it also, but the fact that Real Madrid has a higher XG through those first 80 minutes is interesting. But then from 81 minutes onward, it explodes, obviously, with a 2.81 combined XG, 1.63 for Real Madrid and 1.18 for Manchester City, as you would expect with the three goals that Real Madrid scored, including one from the spot. But, you know, I keep hearing also about this kind of like this mysticism of the Bernabeu. It's kind of the same things growing up that you would hear about Yankee Stadium. You know, the Yankees would come back, like you think about 0-1 against the Diamondbacks, those back-to-back nights of two-run home runs with two outs in the ninth to tie it up. Like you just hear about it's there's ghosts in there that won't allow this team to lose. And I don't know. I think players make things happen. Like I think about the way this game ended and it's almost selling Real Madrid short to just say, well, there's just a spirit lurking in that place that just makes these miracles happen. Like other teams might give up in a way that I think these players, it's just kind of pounded into their heads that they are not going to. And I think about how Manchester City could have, you know, we thought it ended on the Mahrez goal. They could have ended this one. Jack Grealish came on. He was very good, created two chances, but think about his first chance. You know, gets in on net, slips one past Courtois, and that's it. Like, you're watching it in real time thinking, and that's that, City are off the... Who was it? Ferland Mendy?
Mendy.
That came flying in on the line to clear it off the line at the last possible second. And then sure enough, just a minute or so later, Grealish gets another opportunity from the same spot. And Courtois, in real time, you thought Grealish just put it wide. You see the replay. Courtois got three fingers on it, smacked it wide.
I think he got studs on it.
Or studs, I'm sorry. Yeah, like three toes on it, smacks it just wide beside the post. You know, so sure, mysticism, whatever. Maybe there is something in there that causes these players to believe. But just the fact that like these Real Madrid players, in the face of what they were going up against, it felt like certain doom, but they don't see it that way. And they played, Ferland Mendy played until the very end to make sure that his team, even though they needed two goals in stoppage time, essentially, he was going to give them the chance to do that. They don't stop. And there's something very, very admirable in that trait when pretty much everyone else has counted this one done. I mean, JJ, you know, we can make fun of you for tweeting that, but Real Madrid supporters, people who have been around this club, who should know better, who should also have that belief. You know, there's stories today about many of them left and missed this unbelievable ending. Now, that was the majority.
One of our listeners left the bar on 85 minutes.
I mean, what are you doing? Like, you've been there for 85 minutes. Just wait five more. Like, why?
That to me is an absolute sporting no-no. You never leave early.
Never.
Never.
Especially in this sport, especially with that team. And, you know, and it's not entirely fair to make it like, oh, Real Madrid fans, they left. Like, that's not the story. When Mahrez scored that goal, JJ, one of the things that I was taken aback by, they panned the crowd afterwards, and Real Madrid fans all rose, and like a new roar kind of went up through that building to urge their team on, almost to say to them, like, you're down two. This is not done. We've been in worse positions than this before. It's not over. And sure enough, you know, I'm sure some of that spirit started to wane as it got closer to the full-time whistle, but the players still believed, and you got to give them infinite credit for that.
Yeah. I don't know if you recall, after the first Madrid comeback against PSG, I said that you should watch out for a certain substitution. Can you remember what that was?
Hold on.
A certain player to come in.
Well, I feel
that you're going to keep seeing it, and he's going to keep having an impact.
I don't think it was Rodrigo. Was it? Okay, no, it was Toni Kroos going off.
Usually, it's Kroos. Oh. In this case, it was Modric coming off. But the substitution
Camavinga, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Andrew, he's unbelievable. He's 19. The energy and verve he gives the midfield is just... Now, look, Kroos is an elder statesman. Modric, an elder statesman too. Obviously, a 19-year-old is going to come in and give you more legs. But his impact across this tournament from a fella who isn't starting has been just breathtaking. And if you're going to give props to... If you're going to talk about, well, don't focus on just the luck. Don't focus on the mysticism. Talk about real things.
Yeah.
Ancelotti got his substitutions right. And I think I also think when he brought in Asensio, he obviously had to gamble a little bit, take a midfielder off, take out Casemiro. But I am not convinced by Casemiro in that midfield. And not like I do know what he brings to the team, but sometimes I think, you know, he's just on long enough before you can get him off.
he's a very good player. I think
he rides the line so close, but I mean, he got away with it last night again. And he also, I don't know if people are noticing these, it's been kind of almost a thread of tackles after things have happened that are still reckless and are still punishable. On the Bernardo Silva, who had it's amazing. We should be, if Jack Grealish lays that one, like puts that one in the net, lays the game to rest, we're talking about Bernardo Silva. Like, he had such a good game. He looked so good last night, so comfortable. But his chance, which saved Courtois made a brilliant save from. You look at Casemiro's tackle then. Like, Casemiro cleans him. The shot's gone, the save's made. And in comes Casemiro and absolutely cleans him. And got, again, it kind of reminded me of the Ramsdale incident at the weekend and a couple of other. I can't remember the other incident I was thinking of, but, you know, tackles after the ball is gone. It's referees seem to be just, forget about it. It's all fine when it's not. But that's an aside. I think Ancelotti got his substitutions absolutely spot on, and they kind of reinvigorated the side. And
yeah, you think?
I mean, Camavinga's ball to Benzema for the equalizer was very, very good, but Benzema found himself in a lot of space and he steered it the right way. Now, if I'm being ultra critical about that, I think Ederson does not do well there. He doesn't see Rodrigo nipping in. He's got two decisions to make. He can either hold, see Rodrigo and try and make a save down at his near post, or he can come and try and like get a fist or a hand or even a tackle on that ball coming in. But he kind of tentatively goes for it. Rodrigo nips in. It's actually a really good finish at the near post. And then we know what happened next.
It's game on at that point. Benzema, 8-goal contribution, 7 goals and 1 assist in 4 games played this season against last year's Champions League finalists, Manchester City and Chelsea. Stunning. That is, I mean, it's going to be a bit of a theme through this podcast today, especially also when we get to the CONCACAF Champions League final from last night. But like, that old cliche, JJ, of your best players making plays in the biggest games. Like, sometimes it's boring to say it, but a lot of times it is the difference. That pass that you talked about there was massive. Obviously, he will score the penalty that wins this one. And you talk also about the substitutions that Ancelotti made. You know, and we've mentioned Camavinga, his importance. But like, obviously, Rodrigo is the hero from this moment.
Sure. I don't mean to downplay it. It's just if you've watched the games, particularly from the PSG game on, it's just
you're right. You're right too.
No, but this isn't it doesn't have to always be a comparison. But we hear so much about guys like in the Premier League, like Declan Rice, young midfielders, and how much he's going to go for, and is he even affordable? You know, where he's going to go for at least 70, 80 million, all that. I'm like, if you're looking anywhere for a player like that, and he's probably not going to go anywhere because he's at Real Madrid.
No, right.
It's Camavinga. It's absolutely, absolutely brilliant.
In terms of the, we've seen some epic Champions League comebacks over the years. Does this go into the top tier? You know, I think of...
Oh, yeah.
I think of, you know, United and Bayern. I think of Liverpool. Well, the reason I asked that, JJ, is because it wasn't the final. You know, Liverpool, AC Milan, 3-0 down, that's the final. Manchester United scoring twice at the end, just like Real Madrid did here, that was in the final.
I know, but we don't have to do it just like by finals, because so many finals are bad. Like, you don't have to do that.
Okay, so then you would put this into the top tier, I would say, along with Liverpool and Barcelona.
Liverpool and Barcelona.
Barcelona PSG, I would think that should probably be in there. And that was round of 16. Does that hurt it at all that it wasn't a little deeper into the tournament?
Which one was round of 16?
PSG Barcelona.
Oh, no, that doesn't hurt it because the sheer scale of the comeback.
Okay. What about does Tottenham Ajax get in? Tottenham needed 3 goals in the final 35 minutes.
100%.
Okay.
It's absolutely in there. Now, I'm not even going to make any qualification on that. It's absolutely in there. 100%. So I would think, though, I know it was a quarterfinal as well, but Deportivo and Milan in the 03-04 season, okay, where Milan won 4-1 at the San Siro, and then at the Estadio Riazor, Depor came back and won 4-0. Like, that Milan, think how good that Milan team was. Like, it was an amazing side. And for a team like Deportivo La Coruña to come back from 4-1 down is just incredible. So that one gets in there too.
I think what makes this one truly special, which is a little bit different than some of the other ones that we're talking about here, is that both legs were fascinating. Like, mm-hmm. It's not to say that Barcelona beating Liverpool 4-0 in the first leg wasn't fascinating in its own way. But like 4-3 followed up by a 3-1 with two goals in the 90th and 91st minutes. Like, both legs, you come out of this thinking, like, individually, those are two of the most incredible games we've seen. And I think it brings this one, this Real Madrid-Manchester City matchup, to an even more, like, I'm not saying it's necessarily better than all of those, but it's...
Well, why do we have to sell it like that? We don't even have to. We're still basking in the glow of what we've just seen. I don't even think you need to go into that kind of thing. What we do need to get into is Manchester City, Andrew. We have to. I mean, what has happened here?
This is, I mean, look, if we're ranking things, then we can continue along that theme. And because they have now, in this era, which has been full of glory for this club, equally, they have developed a horrifying catalog of defeats, of killer defeats, brutal, morale-crushing defeats. And this is near the top. It might be at the top.
This is near the top. Can we listen to Pep Guardiola talking immediately after the game with BT Sports' Des Kelly, just for some context here?
It's been heartbreaking for City. It's almost impossible to process what happens. But can you try? What happened in the end? Why did it slip away?
Well, it's simple. So the first half, we didn't have a game. We were not good enough, but we didn't suffer much. No. And after the goal, when we scored a goal, is when we were better. We found our tempo, our game. The players were comfortable on the pitch. And apparently, it's not like we say, last 10 minutes, they attack, and you suffer. It didn't happen. Yeah. In that moment, you can say, okay, there were 10, 15 minutes completely attack. We could not survive. It's not the case. And they put a lot of players in the box with Militao, with Rodrigo, with Vinicius, with Benzema, with Asensio. All of them crosses, and they score two goals.
I mean, he's not wrong. City weren't hurt. They weren't, like he said, under pressure. So in the past eliminations, the finger of blame has been pointed pretty squarely at Pep. We talked about Pep brain, mm-hmm. Pep overthinking it. And I suppose the question is, has this happened again in this situation?
I don't believe that it did.
The consensus is that it hasn't. So I'm going to present to you that this headline from Michael Cox in The Athletic kind of sums it up. Like Ancelotti, Guardiola got his subs right. There's not much more he could have done. That is generally the consensus, that these were bolts from beyond, that there wasn't much that could be done. Now, there has to be, like you said, like you framed it, Andrew, there's been a list of these horrifying results under Guardiola. So there, you know, we are pattern-seeking creatures. Miguel Delaney is one of those creatures, and he takes a different line. He says this: there is clearly something here that goes beyond basic luck, as even Carlo Ancelotti mentioned, or the basic madness of the game. This doesn't just happen. It happens for a reason, and there's probably a few reasons at that, but there's obviously psychology, but also identity, and probably even tactics. Okay, so here's the damning indictment. Consider the following. Of Guardiola's 11 eliminations from the Champions League, going back to the first in 09-10, a huge 8 have seen periods that have involved flurries of goals conceded or astounding collapses. So he goes 9-10, the Internazionale semifinal, 2 goals in 13 minutes. 2014, Bayern Munich semifinal, 3 goals in 18. 2015, Barcelona semifinal, 3 and 17. 2017, Monaco, last 16, 2 and 8. And here we get into the City. We're in the City period there. The Monaco one was City. Mm-hmm. 2018, the Liverpool quarterfinal. Remember those 3 goals at Anfield in 19 minutes? 2019, Tottenham Hotspur quarterfinal, 2 goals in 3 minutes. 2020, Lyon quarterfinal, 2 goals in 8 minutes. 2022, Real Madrid semifinal, 3 goals in 6. And here's where we get back to. And it's a place we've been before, Andrew, particularly on this podcast. Miguel finishes, it is something systemic. Because Guardiola is so intent on control, it means his teams don't know how to handle situations when they lose it. We talked about it before, the kind of deeply organized way that they play. And when there is a little glitch in the circuitry, they find that they cannot react. That first Rodrigo goal should not have meant that a second one happens, but it was almost inevitable. And that's why this is a collapse. And this is something that you can trace back to the manager, according to Miguel. I don't know where I'm at with this. I'm curious where you fall.
Here's what I would say. That what he lays out there, I'd be lying if I said that is not really compelling. And he makes interesting points. Now, the only thing is that in some way, like, I've drawn a conclusion. Now I'm going to go back and find the evidence that supports the conclusion that I want.
Because the
only reason I ask that is because, okay, well, how many other times have Manchester City in other important Champions League moments conceded a goal and then been fine and gone on and won? Like, he's not citing those. These are just ones that.
Circumstantial. It's not going to happen every time, but we've been talking about this for a while on the podcast that, you know, if you remember Guardiola's comments after that Champions League game in 17-18 against Liverpool, that quarterfinal, they were almost word for word what Miguel wrote. He said, just because we concede the first goal doesn't mean the second and the third happen. But it seems to me it is a theme of this team that if they get rattled, not always, but in certain games, particularly in the Champions League, if they get rattled, they find it very hard to compose themselves again and come back. Here's the other argument. You know, all right, Rodrigo gets his 2 goals. It's going to extra time. Like, that is lots and lots of time for City to regroup, reshape themselves, and go again. And it didn't happen. It felt like there was, like I said, the truck of Real Madrid was just rolling down the hill. But that shouldn't be an inevitability. Like, how can a team that is so well-drilled, organized to within an inch of their life, organized to the point where some of us believe that Jack Grealish has been subsumed into the machine completely and has lost almost all individualism. Although it's funny, in defeat, those two little chances that he had, the one that he dragged past the post that was saved by Courtois, and obviously the one that Ferland Mendy saved off the line, they were really the biggest glimpses of old Jack.
Right. He came on and he was an instant difference maker and nearly a hero.
He was Aston Villa Jack. But just, you know, back to the point, like, everything is so mechanically and methodically thought out that, you know, they're not. The other point Miguel goes on to make is that, I know you've talked about, well, there are instances where they come back and they finish the job when they go 1-0 down. I'm sure there are, but they win so many games in the Premier League. In all competitions, they win the majority of their games, and that they're not used to this adversity. And when it comes in the big pressure moment in the Champions League, they fold. And I hear people screaming, well, Liverpool win most of their games. It doesn't happen to them. Well, I think Liverpool dwell in the chaos better than City do.
I mean,
it's tough. I'm not sure where I land on it either. But you can't, like, it's not fair just to talk about Real Madrid's mystique and look and just give City a pass.
No, of course not. And I don't know that anyone is. yeah, it's like I said, it's compelling. And you almost feel sorry for Pep because, like,
no,
but it causes you to almost, like, you hear all that and it almost messes with your brain in this way. It makes you think, huh, maybe he's a detriment, but he's not. Like, he might be the greatest manager of all time. Yeah. So
that's interesting that you'd say that he might be a detriment. That is interesting.
I mean, that's essentially, like, not so bluntly, but that's sort of the point that's being made. He has a style that, okay, over the course of like a club season, when you're playing 38 games and, you know, 32 of them or whatever are against teams that aren't that good, it doesn't matter. But in the Champions League, pretty much every game you play is going to be against a great team. And so it's not always going to be comfortable. Teams are going to make you uncomfortable. And maybe he's not the guy cut out for uncomfortable situations. That's the point he's making. He's essentially telling you, like, this is not, if you want to win a Champions League, this is not the guy for you.
That's big if true, Andrew.
This is legacy stuff that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And he has Champions Leagues to his name.
He does, but he doesn't have them of late. And he's been at some pretty well-primed teams in which to execute that.
This is a lot. I wasn't prepared for this conversation.
My whole world
has kind of been turned upside
down.
We
were here in 2020 after Lyon. I remember us having pretty frank conversations, and we thought maybe he'd run his course at Manchester City. I actually don't think there's anything to suggest that he's leaving City or that the City ownership want him to move on. I'm not saying that at all, but you can't pretend like we haven't been here before with Pep. And I'm not sure where I fall on it either, whether it was just act of Real Madrid or...
I know, but here's the problem, though, to, like, take a bucket of cold water and throw it in our faces and, like, rejuvenate us back to consciousness. Like, what I always say, my whole thing of, like, let's not just forget about players who make great plays or make mistakes. Like, they're a part of this. This isn't just Pep. You know, like, Ruben Diaz, for example... Who's kind of been anointed as another Van Dijk. Well, he's not. He's great. He's a great player. I'd love to have him on my team, of course. But, like, he's not another Van Dijk. That penalty was bad. He was late to that ball.
Well, what would lead him to make that kind of tackle at that moment in the game with the player? Thierry Henry said it was absolute insanity. Why? I mean, Benzema is not moving toward the goal. He's going nowhere. What to go in like that?
Because he made a mistake. It was a bad play.
I mean, it was just unnecessary, and that shows the panic that was filtering through the side.
I mean, like, is it Pep's? You know, is it on Pep that like I say, sometimes you just have to tip your hat. Jack Grealish essentially scored the goal to seal it. Like, Ferland Mendy just made an unbelievable play to prevent it from happening. Like,
you're right. This is the argument, and we're not going to solve it here right now. Whether it's whether it's systems or individual players or after last night, though, I do understand more and more about the modern foreign non-English manager who talks about actions and moments. I mean, it's literally all the game is little moments that of genius, of our inspiration, of skill, just actions and moments. And that's all it is. And Real Madrid had the right actions in the right moments in this game.
I'll tell you what, let's go ahead, let's collect ourselves, we'll take a break, we'll come back. There was another Champions League semifinal of which we need to discuss, Liverpool advancing to their third in the past 5 years, and then we still haven't even gotten to the CONCACAF Champions League final where an MLS club, I mean, imagine that. Imagine like how many big things would have needed to happen for us not to be leading with the fact that MLS has finally broken through in the CONCACAF Champions League. Like, that's the kind of day that we're dealing with here. Let's go ahead.
We've also got a mini mailbag.
Oh,
Andrew.
My God. And you haven't even shown me any of those.
No. It's better for your blood pressure. You don't see them.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. There's still a lot to do. Back now on Caught Offside on an unbelievable Champions League week, both domestic and abroad.
Oh, unbelievable. And the unbelievableness doesn't stop there, Andrew. This is Gabby Agbonlahor on TalkSport with probably the most disengaged, out of touch comment you're ever likely to hear in the current football climate.
Yeah, he's talking about he doesn't understand English fans not supporting City. Here he is.
You had the hump last night, but you were watching the game, didn't you?
So I went out to watch the game last night in a bar in London, and sitting there met a few of my friends watching it, you know, supporting the English team in Manchester City. Whenever Real Madrid scored, 99% of the bar, there could have been about 1,000 people in the bar jumping up celebrating for Real Madrid.
Really?
Which baffles me. And I spoke to a couple of them around me who said to me, why are you not celebrating? I says, I'm supporting the English team. There were a few Man United fans, Chelsea, other teams. But really disappointing to me, strange, because you want to support the English team to get an all-English final, which was strange for me to see that.
What?
Like, I mean, I cannot be with him on this one.
What is he talking about? Unbelievable. I mean, Man United fans, of course they're not going to shout for City. Of course they're not. Chelsea fans, no chance. Like, if Birmingham City were in the UEFA Cup semi-final, the big rival of Aston Villa, would Gabby Agbonlahor be tutting at people in the bar and Villa fans not supporting Birmingham? What is he on about?
No one wants great things for their rival club.
No.
Like that doesn't suddenly shut off because the competition is different. It's still like you want Manchester City to have those kind of bragging rights. By the way, like they're not exactly the neutral's favorite. I don't know if you've noticed that.
They're not beloved at all. And Micah Richards tweeting before the semifinal last night, why does everybody want City to lose? With like question mark crying emojis. If I'm a supporter of, particularly if I'm not a Liverpool supporter, if I'm say a Newcastle or a Crystal Palace, or maybe not, actually Palace is a terrible example, but any other club that gets routinely battered by Manchester City and has had to watch them like come in and with all that money, don't forget City came from nowhere to be something. Because of a whole load of money. So that's going to have a huge amount of envy amongst other fans. They're absolutely gutted that this has happened. They're never going to be the neutral's favorite, ever.
It's not
like Chelsea in 2005. Oh, you know, imagine, why does everyone hate us? Chelsea fans would never say that because they know why.
Of course. It's not an exact parallel, but I just sort of think of myself and like, you know, when the New York Giants have been in Super Bowls, I would even if it was against the Patriots, a team that I've got no love for, I may as well have been wearing a Tom Brady jersey for those Giants.
Yeah.
Patriots. Like, I don't want the Giants, one of my rivals, to have that over me, another Super Bowl. Like,
imagine going on national radio and saying these things.
Like in college basketball, when the Big East was thriving, like, and UConn was going to the titles. Do you know how hard, as a Syracuse fan, I rooted against UConn? Do you have like any idea? Like this, I don't know. This is like way out of touch.
Oh, but crazy. And also the general tribalism of Premier League football. The idea because they're English. In what way is, you know, nationalism really going to spread into like the modern Premier League club with foreign owners and different players from all around the world?
Yeah. Now, like, I will say this. I will say one thing. We're going to sort of, in a way, revisit this conversation when we get to the CONCACAF Champions League final. This type of conversation.
No, I wasn't shouting for Seattle. I was just watching the game.
Okay. I don't know if you were in the majority in that way.
You were there wearing your MLS cap like Rob Lowe.
I was full kit W with a Jordan Morris kit. Yes, exactly right. Before we get to that though, JJ, let's finish up on the UEFA Champions League.
Sure.
And it's Liverpool going back once again, seeking revenge against Real Madrid. This did not go according to plan, I think you would have to say. But in the end, it's the result we expected.
Yeah, I thought...
You might have pooped your pants at a certain point in this first half.
Oh, the second goal, absolutely. Yeah. And Capoue's cross was so good. Like, it was really, really so good. I thought Villarreal were, and again, it's easy to talk about a team being, I sound like Pep Guardiola, you know, when someone gets battered by Man City, and he's asked after the game. That was very easy. Pep, and he goes, no, so hard, so hard. That team was so, so good. So, so good. I'm not going to, I don't want to sound like Pep, but I thought Villarreal were brilliant in the first half. I thought they were, I thought what they did was, and I'm not saying Emery was watching old tape from like the fall, but the 3-3 at Brentford, where Brentford were putting long diagonal balls in behind the fullbacks and then putting pressure, pinning the fullbacks in. Because what you have to remember about Liverpool is, as much as you're trying to expose, say, the defensive weaknesses of Trent Alexander-Arnold, it's more than that. It works two ways. You're also pinning him back, meaning he can't do his offensive things. And they really focused on that. I thought they put a huge amount of pressure on Fabinho and Thiago and kind of shut them down. And they were, it was such an intense performance that Liverpool got blown away by it. They were really panicky, struggling to put any passes together. But Liverpool went in, regrouped, Villarreal ran out of steam. And the second half, once Liverpool got that first goal, composed themselves, they kind of, they ran away with it, really. It was a dominant second half performance from them. But the XG at halftime, 1.21 for Villarreal, 0.06 for Liverpool. That's how little they really got at the Yellow Submarine in the first half.
That is like unheard of stuff for this Liverpool side. And pretty shocking. It just makes me wonder a little bit of like how much of this was tactics, how much of this was the mental, emotional side of it. Liverpool, like, did Liverpool take their opponent lightly? Like, that's not a quality that I associate with Jurgen Klopp's side. Was there any of that, that they just weren't ready for what they were walking into?
I really want to give Villarreal credit. I think the intensity they brought in that game was such a complete day and night scenario from what they brought in the first game. Like I said, they pinned the fullbacks in. They kind of crowded out the midfield. And the second half, really, Liverpool got Trent Alexander-Arnold further up the field. They got on the front foot again. They started linking the play. And it was, I can't remember who was on commentary. I think, was it, I don't know who the co-commentator was.
But it was Jim Beglin. I think it might
have, Jim Beglin, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Jim Beglin said, right before halftime, that's been such a good half by Villarreal. But how will they keep that intensity up? And ultimately, they weren't able. But that was a performance they can be, again, I sound so patronizing, but that's something they can be super proud of.
Pat on the head.
I don't know. What do you want me to say, really? I mean, it's not fair to talk like this, but I also feel that Geronimo Rulli.
Here we go.
The first two goals that he conceded, you know, Diaz's header through the legs, maybe give him a pass on that. The Fabinho goal, I can't. Like, Fabinho just lashed it at him, and he's got to be better with his feet. And then obviously the Sadio Mane goal, where he just comes racing out and gets nothing. Nothing. How Villarreal can be a team in a Champions League semi-final with a goalkeeper like that is, it's beyond me.
He had a nightmarish performance.
Oh, nightmare.
And it's compounded by the fact of how hard his team worked to get back into this.
Correct. That's the whole thing. I mean, somebody, I can't remember, was it a Spanish newspaper, gave Alisson the same player rating as Rulli. Which is, yeah, that was a choice.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're seeing, maybe my pea brain, I don't know. It was horrifying to watch, I thought, and I felt bad for that guy. Aside from like his mistakes, and aside from Villarreal potentially just sort of losing steam, like Jim Beglin talked about, like you talked about, did Liverpool change anything? I mean, I know substitutions were made, and we'll talk about one of those players in particular, I'm sure. But did you sense any like dramatic changes to bring the fullbacks into the attack to limit opportunities for Villarreal?
No, I from what I saw was just like Liverpool stepped up the intensity, because they, like in the first half, they just seemed to be unable to link the passes. Do you know what I mean? Like there was always a turnover opportunity in midfield for Villarreal, and they completely shut that off in the second half. It was so much crisper. so much more to feed. The movement was so much better. And I guess that came from what Jurgen Klopp said at halftime to them, because in the first half, the energy expended by Villarreal in that first half and closing Liverpool players down, I really do think that was a key factor. I mean, this is not something that they regularly do. And look at their league position in La Liga. You know, it speaks volumes for where the club is on a week in, week out basis. So to ask them to go and play that way, to shut down one of the best teams in Europe for 45 minutes and then tell them to go and do it again, I think that was the difference.
What about Luis Diaz, JJ? We talk about machines, the way Pep operates. You know, for Klopp, there's a certain bit of that as well. In the way, you know, his trademark style that this Liverpool side has played with since he arrived there. And I think one thing that is admirable about Liverpool is that, you know, there is some like Diaz has come into this side, and the transition for him into this Liverpool machine, he just fits in so seamlessly. Like, I can't believe, like, with Diego Jota, he fit in seamlessly, but it took a little bit. Like, he was kind of off the bench a little bit. But Diaz comes in, and there's no drop-off. If anything, they look even better. It's been an incredible signing and an amazing arrival that he's made and an impact that he's made at this club.
Yeah, it's huge. And I suppose I really haven't talked about his introduction enough in terms of turning the tide of the game. It's funny. Like, at any period in football, I would say that there's some commentator saying, ah, that's the difference in that team. A guy who can get the ball quickly and take someone on and run at them. And that just rings true with Diaz. Andrew, he's so difficult to deal with. He's so direct as well. Thierry Henry was talking about him on Paramount Plus, and he made the exact same points as I'm making now, is that he ups the pace of the game by the fact that he gets on the ball quickly and it's go forward all the time. And if he's not on it, he's making those runs like how he ghosted in for his header. For him, it's a credit to Liverpool's recruitment that they can spot these players. Most of the time, there have been exceptions, but most of the time they can spot a player and they can say, right, that guy can come in and he will acclimatize relatively quickly. But if you look at some of the other signings that they've made, like, as good as Andy Robertson is now in this system, he didn't acclimatize. He acclimatized quickly, but not nearly as quickly as Luis Diaz. I remember when they signed Robertson and he didn't start the first few games, and I thought, he didn't feature. I was like, I wonder what's going on here. But by the end of the season, he was completely inculcated into their whole idea of play. Diaz has just hit the ground running. And that's why I guess they were so aggressive in taking him from under the nose of Tottenham.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is like, this was not, see, this is, we can talk about that their recruitment is special and they scout players so well. I think this wasn't a secret, and Tottenham, their interest was serious. And there's this thought out there that it accelerated Liverpool's interest to bringing him in January, as opposed to waiting till the summer. And, you know, you can even go back. I saw this quote from Pepe, formerly of Real Madrid, and a teammate at Porto with Diaz, and he said this last season. He said, Luis Diaz is the example of the professionalism and passion we have playing for FC Porto. We know of the importance of wearing this shirt, and I'm proud to share the locker room with Luis Diaz. Yeah. You know, so this guy he's a special player, and the impact that he's making right now for Liverpool is hard to calculate just how valuable he has been. JJ,
just one more thing. And it just wasn't happening for Jota. Just one of those nights, like, and Diaz came in, and like I said, he was a bit of a spark. I don't think he was the only reason that Liverpool turned it around, but certainly a big part of it.
You mentioned before your patronizing tone when talking about Villarreal.
Trying to not be.
So I was curious to get your thought on this and the way this game will be remembered. So I'm in the fantasy Premier League that you used to be in, and then you got too good or whatever and you decided you couldn't be in it anymore. So it's still, the league still exists, and we have an email chain, and in it somebody said this about the broadcast. I guess it was Beglin, and they cited a quote that they thought was really annoying. And so they emailed and they said, the quote was, they'll be telling the Villarreal fans, they'll be telling their kids about this for years, but with a sad ending. I guess that was Jim Beglin's quote. And my buddy said, what? No, they won't. No Villarreal fan will be retelling the story of this game ever.
I bet you that was a There'd be a lot of bitters in that group, though. A lot of blue noses. Huge amount of blue noses,
so I'll
correct?
Ask, without identifying who said it.
Yeah, yeah. Of course there is.
So I'll ask you, how would a Villarreal fan remember a game like that? Is that one that you look back on with some fondness, or because of being 2-0 up and then handing away three goals with some bad goalkeeping to make it kind of a blowout in the end, do you wipe that from your mind right away? I'm having a hard time. That's why I ask you.
No, I think, like, a club of their size, this was an exceptional run that they went on. You know, the teams that they, you know, knocking out Bayern Munich. So if you're talking in the whole, like in the
well,
larger,
no one will deny that the run gets remembered forever. This was legendary stuff, and Villarreal fans will always look back on the run fondly. But I guess the game is what was being talked about. Like, will you be able to look back, oh, remember we were up 2-0, how the excitement, the noise of that second goal? Or do you immediately think, yeah, but the second half ruins all that, I don't ever want to think about it again?
No, I don't think so. I think they'll remember it fondly. Like, that was such an amazing moment for them. And just, like, it was beyond their wildest dreams for them to be in that position. They'll be tinged with disappointment, but, yeah, they'll remember it.
I think it's kind of how I feel when I think about the Confederations Cup final between the U.S. and Brazil. When the U.S., I mean, literally, it was kind of the same thing. The U.S. went up 2-0 in the first half and then gave up three goals in the second half to lose. But I still don't, it's not like a bad memory. Like, it was the disappointment of that loss really stung because I thought the U.S. had it.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily a bad memory. Like, the excitement of that first half going up two goals, I don't know. It's kind of like it doesn't hurt as much looking back on that as you would normally think a 3-2 final defeat would.
If they'd have got hammered, like blown out, Liverpool win that second leg 3-0 or 4-0, then it'd be different. Then they'd be like, yeah, I'm blot that from the memory. But the fact that they gave themselves such a chance is a point of pride.
Yeah.
Of course.
So we have our final. JJ, I cannot believe this, but Liverpool are going to play in every game that there is this season. I believe it's 62 out of a possible 62 games.
63 matches. Liverpool are the second team in English football history to play in every single game they are eligible for in a season. The only other team to do it, Liverpool in 1981, who went on to win the European Cup by beating Real Madrid in
Paris.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Oh, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. It's heritage, Andrew.
Okay. In terms of this, I mean, obviously, in the weeks to come, we'll have a more comprehensive preview of the match. But
we might have a podcast once again from the venue.
No.
Yep. We might.
Where are things at?
There's probably a flight going to be booked straight after this podcast.
Oh, so this is not a might. You're going.
Yeah, but I don't have a ticket. I need a ticket for the game. So I'm calling on all Caught Offside listeners. I'm calling on all corporate sponsors, anybody, because there'll be even less tickets than there were for Kiev when I paid, as Ron Atkinson would say, silly money.
I have so much respect for the way you live your life. Like, I'm so cautious and, like, careful. Like, I would just never... You're going to book a flight to Paris before you even have a ticket to the game. Like, I would never do these things. I'm just, like, too methodical, and I think about everything that can go wrong. Like,
so you're calling me just a brainless ninny?
No, because it's going to work out for you. Like, I know you'll make it so it works. You'll just, like, it'll happen.
You know, all the nonsense...
And I get too caught up in all the what-ifs. You just go
for it.
Yeah, but
you know all the... You know all the nonsense that is spoken in post-match games, particularly in college sports. And the coach always says, just put ourselves in good positions to win the football game.
Yeah.
Like, putting yourself in the position to get a ticket is the thing to do. So that's what I'm doing.
Are you going alone?
Yeah, but I love friends.
Another thing I would... amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So you're just...
It's not for me. I've always kind of... done things on my own. It's pretty sad.
Wow.
I'll be meeting a friend of mine, should be at the final.
Yeah, I mean, you got loads of Liverpool fan friends. I'm sure you'll have no shortage of people there, but just this is incredible stuff. Liverpool open up as -195 favorites over Real Madrid. Real Madrid are +155. That's at Caesar Sportsbook.
Yeah. Imagine, Andrew, sorry to go off on a tangent. Imagine, though, we've worked this long for ESPN and I have to go around scrounging for tickets.
Oh, yeah, forget it. I mean,
embarrassment, isn't it? Where are we?
Forget it. Initially, right out of the gate, I mean, what's your gut, if we do this, then?
Yeah, my initial gut response was delighted not to have City because it would bring so much of that, like, kind of tension and, just that sickly feeling in the pit of your stomach to play your main rival in another big game outside of England in the Champions League final. And I also think for the competition itself, it's not good to have two back-to-back seasons with English teams in it. And I include Liverpool in that. So whatever way we had to have it, it was good to have another team in it.
This competition is more fun for me as a neutral when teams from different leagues are matched up against one another.
Oh,
it's just more interesting. It's more compelling.
It really is. And as fun as 2019 was for us, it was still, you know, I think you would have far sooner had Tottenham versus Ajax in the final, or Tottenham versus Real Madrid, or Tottenham versus
even Barcelona.
Yeah, I think you would have absolutely preferred that. And I can see why. When City went out last night, it was, but plus, and no disrespect to the City fans, though, there is this unbelievably compelling story from Real Madrid, you know, that people are going to want to watch more than they're going to want to watch Man City, considering what they've done. And that was partly the neutral, the team of destiny is a worry for me. It's definitely a worry, but I much prefer the fact we're playing Real Madrid. Are Liverpool the clear favorite? Like, I think I won't change my stance. I think football team wise, Liverpool are a better football team, but I think on the magical mysticism side, Real Madrid are, if you can go to mysticismbets.org, Real Madrid are the favorites.
That's on the dark web.
That's on the dark web. Yeah. After you visited the animals on Reddit.
I mean, look, the logic in me feels that Liverpool should win this. Now, look, that's, you know how highly I think of Real Madrid. I've been honking that horn for weeks now, months now. So, like, there are elements of Real Madrid. Like, if Benzema is just on one that night, then what are you going to do?
Vinicius and Carvajal have to be on one too.
Yeah, you know, and Vinicius has been. Yeah. So, you know, it's certainly possible. I think, you know, a 3-0 here would shock me. Like, I think Real Madrid will give a good showing, but I don't know how you slow down this Liverpool attack right now. And I think that's kind of in the weeks to come, like, that's sort of what I'll be keying on.
There's people saying, you know, Liverpool, Real Madrid of the league wrapped up. I say there's people saying, there's a friend of mine, Cormac, I'll give him credit. Real Madrid of the league wrapped up. And so they can just look after themselves, rest up, and figure it out over the next few weeks. Now, we've said before, this long gap to the final doesn't always help. Liverpool have massive games. Every game is a cup final, including an actual cup final.
And an unofficial cup final this weekend.
The Caught Offside Cup final. Yeah. So what shape will Liverpool find themselves in come the end of that gauntlet? We don't know.
That's one of those things that I can't mess around with, that whole conversation. That whole thing bothers me, because it's one of those things where you can shape it to whatever you want. Oh, well, Liverpool are playing important games, so they're in their flow. Like, you know, but if Real Madrid come out and have a bad Champions League final, it's because, oh, well, they've been playing meaningless games for too long, and so it took them out of their momentum. Like, so I don't know. Maybe if Real Madrid win, oh, well, they were able to rest guys. I don't know. That's a hard conversation to have. I always am annoyed with that whole thing. But it should be fascinating. I think also Real Madrid in sort of the post-Ronaldo era, this is a big moment for them and for Benzema in particular, to kind of assert a new, like really a new legacy without him. Should be fascinating. And I can't believe you're going to be there. We'll have to.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I'll get off this call and I'll try and figure it out. Me and Gay Paris.
Wow. All right, let's take one more break. When we come back, we'll do a little CONCACAF Champions League final, as MLS has broken through in the form of the Seattle Sounders, and JJ has told me we have a mailbag as well. So there is still more to come here on Caught Offside.
Rusnak weaving his way through, got it across. Vargas, Rui Diaz, miss hit, it bounces in! Morris from Alex Roldan, Talavera backing off, Ladero, Rui Diaz! Morris controls, Jordan Morris! Off the post, Ladero's rebound! 3-0!
It has happened. It has happened. Congratulations to the Seattle Sounders, CONCACAF Champions League title holders. They did it last night, 3-0 over Pumas in the CONCACAF Champions League final in front of over 68,000 at Lumen Field. It was an unbelievable atmosphere, a record-setting crowd. They were loud as hell. That second goal in particular, JJ, I saw one of those videos like where it's just kind of like a guy on the field with his phone who was just happened to be filming as the goal happened. The second one was really, the Rui Diaz one felt like that was kind of it.
That was the icing on the cake.
Yeah, they did add a third, but that second one was sort of the one where you could really breathe. And the unbelievable noise generated from that place was really, it was something, and it was a fun occasion. And it feels, I don't know, maybe there will be people that roll their eyes at this. I was kind of talking about this when Seattle got to the final. This feels right to me, just with how good the Sounders team has been, this franchise, club, whatever you want to call them, like how well run they've been, the trophies that they have to their name, the way they've built this. It just, like, I don't know, if I were going to just pick a team to be the first to break down this barrier, this might have been the one that, taking biases and all that aside, like this might have been the team that I would pick to have done it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I not just that they're an ever-present in MLS, but if you were sending a representative out to represent the league in the, you know, particularly in the past few seasons, they'd be the one. I think it's more than that, though. It was, even in its creation, it was such a Seattle performance, you know. So you had all the elements of Seattle-ness. You had a huge crucial save at 1-0 on 64 minutes from Stefan Fry. Ticked that box off. And then the goal on 80 minutes was just a Seattle goal through and through. Jordan Morris running the channel in transition. Neat pass inside, followed by another neat pass. Morris, Ladero, Raul Rui Diaz. Like, it's just a classic.
Yeah.
And for Morris then to hit the post and Ladero to follow up in the third. Like I said, it was the icing on the cake. And we also had, in my opinion, and maybe I should start listening to him more. Maybe he doesn't come out with these gems, but whenever I really pay attention to what Brian Schmetzer says, he always says something that makes me chuckle. And I thought this was a classic. So he's been asked about Rui Diaz's two goals. And this is what he said. Raul is a killer in a good way, not in a bad way.
Thank you for clarifying.
As if it needed to be clarified. Yeah. That's like something my mother would say.
Right.
Oh, I'll absolutely murder you. But it's not actually murder. You know what I mean? Like, just so, like, there's no qualification needed. And he goes on. And you know, in the NFL, they have the franchise players. Isn't that what they have? You can call Nico the franchise player. Like, again, he's not even sure that that's what it's called.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a proud history that the Sounders have. Clint Dempsey and, you know. But I think you can look at this and say that Ladero is the greatest player in Sounders history.
By a country mile. Yeah. He's one of the greatest players that's ever set foot in the league.
Yes. So a couple things that stood out to me in this, a bunch of things, but start with this. This did not start well. Like, if whatever excitement there was in the buildup and the enthusiasm from that building, two bad injuries early. Like, that's not setting the right tone. João Paulo out. And that might be a serious injury. I haven't seen it officially, but they're looking at his ACL. You know, he was on crutches afterwards for the trophy ceremony. So they won this, but they still have a season to play, and that could be important. So we'll keep an eye on that. But he goes out. Nuhu goes out. This is all, like, very quickly, early in this game. And this was, you know, now a 16-year-old in Obed Vargas that came on in the 29th minute. He's now got a give him, like, you know, 65 minutes or so. So, like, it was, whatever good feelings there were when this was nil-nil,
and the enthusiasm on their side and the building's on their side, some of that momentum could have been sucked away, but it wasn't. Pumas didn't really do much to capitalize on that. And, you know, the players that came in, Kellen Rowe and Vargas himself at 16, they came in and they did a great job to kind of keep this in check. And there was just a sense of calmness around this. There was not panic around the Sounders. And then they get, you know, the fortunate bounce on the goal, huge deflection, which, by the way, would have been a penalty anyway. The referee played advantage on that goal, but it would have been a handball in the box, so they would have had a penalty. And that was such a huge moment, because whatever nerves there might have been through those injuries and how they're going to look, getting that goal right going into halftime, that was a huge kind of, okay, we can breathe going into the locker room. We can, you know, now we can just make adjustments to having this lead. And then, JJ, the second goal that you talked about, how it was such a Sounders goal, I thought that too. It's funny you say that. I thought the same exact thing. And I wonder if you thought this too, because you're so infatuated with the pitch, turf, pitch talk, all that stuff. You know, the two passes that were made to get to Rui Diaz, like first from Morris to Ladero and then from Ladero to Rui Diaz. Like, they had to be weighted perfectly.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, the Sounders know every inch of that turf, of how fast that turf moves. And so, like, when I saw the play developing, I was like, ooh, they could have something here, but they got to get these passes right. Like, you could see it developing perfectly in front of you where Rui Diaz was making his run. But they had to get the passes right. And other teams might not, that aren't used to playing on that fast surface. And they did. Ladero especially, because he took it first time right to Rui Diaz. And you're
those
right. It was such a Sounders goal in that building specifically.
Yeah, it's so easy to overhit a pass on those surfaces, Atlanta, Seattle, but they perfectly measured. And like you said, that's the inside knowledge they have. I think if you're looking at it from the Pumas side of things, to go there and have only one shot on target, That's going to rankle for a long time. That's going to be a sore point for Pumas, because, you know, it's not, they were, the first leg was so tight, and I think they let themselves down a little bit in the second leg, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, a 3-0 loss, that's a fair statement, I would say.
So, like,
and not a ton of opportunities. I mean, the best save that Fry had to make on the night was one that didn't even count.
Which was, just for the sheer brilliance of the save, the reflexes of it, it's kind of a shame it didn't count. The flag was up, but it was such a super reaction save. So I suppose it's a big credit to Seattle then, Andrew.
Of course. I mean, they've done it, right?
Your de facto MLS team outside of
the
Union.
They're the first MLS club to win this competition since its rebranding in 2008-2009. The last 16 winners have all been Liga MX. Saprissa of Costa Rica was the last non-Liga MX side to win this back in 2005. It's just an incredible stranglehold that Liga MX has had on this competition. And it brings us back a little bit now to the conversation we were having earlier about, like, neutral rooting interests. And I think that there was something different. Not I think, there was. There was objectively something different about this, because JJ, you know, that American brain of ours, it never stops working, it never stops thinking, and it's always thinking about perceptions. And we are keenly aware of the way we as American soccer fans are perceived around the world. Like, for us to gain credibility, this league has to thrive. And as long as MLS clubs, for however far they advance, for however far they advance in this tournament, until they start accumulating trophies, you know, and now, like, Seattle's going to go play Liverpool or Real Madrid potentially in the FIFA Club World Cup. Like, that's never, you know, we haven't seen that before other than, like, summer friendlies. You know, so, like, there's any ground that can be made up in the American soccer community from a credibility standpoint, it all matters. And I think a lot of American fans, not all, Portland fans were not rooting for Seattle last night.
No, they were not.
You can definitively say that. And I'm sure there were other Western Conference teams that, you know, it wouldn't shock me if the Galaxy were not rooting for the Sounders. Like, there are other, Vancouver, other rivals of theirs that were definitely not rooting for them. But I think as a whole, you know, you saw the way that this was covered on Fox, on MLSsoccer.com. Like, it was, you know, it was covered like we all won something yesterday. And I think a lot of American soccer fans felt that way, at least a little bit, watching that.
I wouldn't overhype the importance of this in terms of, like, you talk about the credibility. I don't feel that anymore. I don't think it's for the league and those that support the league and are really deep into the league. Yeah, it's huge. It means a lot.
This league, JJ, is dumped on constantly. oftentimes without merit. You really, by people all over the world who have never watched a second of it, who don't know a thing about it. So,
This will not raise a beep around the world.
No, maybe not. But you're thinking Eurocentric. No, maybe not in Europe. Like, for whatever, maybe they've written their narrative on what this is. But in this part of the world, Mexican fans, maybe, you know, or Central American fans that think, oh, MLS, like whatever, they're all hype and money, but like, where's the substance? You know, so it all, I don't know. To me, it meant something last night.
Okay. I think it meant something. I'm always wary about the credibility thing because I think we've moved on a bit from that.
I think I disagree.
Okay.
I think you're reading it wrong. I think you are reading it wrong.
Hey, wouldn't be the first time.
Here was Garth Lagerwey. So MLSsoccer.com had the extra time guys there pitch side, and he joined them straight afterwards. It was a great interview. You can see it up on their website. But here he was talking about MLS being right there with Liga MX.
Look, we're a good team. We spent a long time building this thing, but you know, there's a lot of good teams in this league. New York City's a great team. LAFC is coming out of the gates, great team. You know, New England had 73 points last year. So, like, there's a bunch of good teams, and that's the whole thing is we're level now with the top Mexican clubs, the top MLS clubs, I believe, can compete on any given day with anybody in Mexico. And you just couldn't say that 5 years ago. And so we are the symbol. We're the tip of the spear. We pushed through. We finally did it. We've anchored the demons. But everybody's welcome, man. We want a crowded mountaintop up here, man. We don't want to be up here by ourselves.
I mean, he's probably right. 5 years ago, you know, teams were getting close, but the league may not have been there yet. And the league has chipped away. And now, you know, it's not just I do think that this is another sign that it's not just the retirement community that a lot of people think it is, that there are legitimately good teams. I don't know how everyone values the Club World Cup. You know, sometimes we kind of just like, whatever, we don't even really think much of it. But I'll be watching it now.
Outside of it's interesting you should ask that. It means an awful lot, apparently, to South and not Central Americans, but South American teams.
Yeah.
Not so much for others, but definitely we underestimated in South America. Yeah, look, it's great. It's great win, great victory. I do think for years what hampered was MLS's preparation. You know, because a lot of teams were, you know, kind of, it felt as if MLS was only waking up from its winter slumber and the CONCACAF Champions League would be upon them. And it's like it caught them by surprise, but they're much better prepared for it now. And Seattle's victory is a testament to that.
Yes, and a testament to their manager as well. I saw this, and it needs to be mentioned. So Ezra Hendrickson, he tweeted this before. This wasn't even last night. This was after Seattle qualified for the final. He said, when you talk about top American coaches, Brian Schmetzer must be in the conversation. Too long now overlooked. Yet another final. Enough respect, brethren. Hashtag mentor, hashtag friend, hashtag numbers don't lie.
Yeah, I was saying that to you off air.
He's in that category.
Of course he is. He's got the hardware to prove it, and he's been consistently successful, and he's kept his job, which for any manager at the top level is he's good, and he's a very unassuming, nice man.
Yeah, and you know, whatever injuries they've been dealt over the years at different points to key players, like they just find a way. Like, they're always good regardless of who's there, who's not there. Dempsey wasn't in MLS Cup final. They win anyway. Like, that's, you know, they've built something, and it's not just him. I mean, Ziggy Schmidt started this, and you know what they've built is really impressive, and it's well deserved. So congratulations to them, to all those fans. I mean, we talk about great fan bases of teams in this league, and they're right up there with any of them. So it was a great scene, and props to them. Fun night in Seattle at Lumen Field. JJ, did you want to close on a mailbag? You got anything else?
Quick mailbag. People wondering why we didn't mention the Christian Pulisic dad tweet, which was then apparently deleted.
It was, yeah.
But I have it here because the internet remembers. Mm-hmm. Mark Pulisic. The sad thing is he loves this club, teammates, and London. Puts his heart and soul into being a pro. Onwards and upwards, my boy. Big 6 months ahead. Which, I mean, I guess... you know, he didn't start against Everton at the weekend, came on late, didn't do very much. Kind of a lightning rod now at the moment for the supporters, suggesting he's been bad. I don't think he's been bad. I think he's been good when he's played, but there's very little going right with that Chelsea attack anyway. So to focus on Pulisic's not fair. I think he's suggesting he probably needs to leave the club but won't want to, or he's looking to get out.
Yeah, it was kind of cryptic in that way. You had to do a little bit of deciphering.
First things first, Chelsea are in a very convoluted and messy and difficult takeover scenario right now, where we're hearing rumours that the previous owner, who said he doesn't want anything out of it, now wants something out of it, and there is a plethora of interested candidates. So we don't know where we are with that yet. So until that's resolved, I don't think he's going anywhere.
No,
But it's one of those, Andrew, where the family, it's not helpful.
I don't think it is either. I don't know if that stuff happening out publicly, who does that serve?
Like, yeah, I don't know either.
There's other, if he wants to go, there's other ways of doing that. You know, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just like a dad's frustration, yeah, you know, and that's not a small thing, and that can boil over in many ways. And you know, it, ultimately, like you said, the tweet was deleted, so cooler heads may have prevailed. Maybe Christian said, "Dad, that is not helping right now." I don't know, but there's been talk now, you know, of Juventus, him and Weston McKennie playing together in Italy. But then there's been talk that I've seen of Antonio Conte, if he remains at Spurs, really wanting Weston McKennie, him being one of his top targets there at Tottenham. So who knows? Transfer rumors are, I mean, I think even in the transfer window, they're ridiculous oftentimes, but we're still here in May. So things are going to change a million times between now and then. But yeah, we've talked, I don't know. It's funny that this came up, JJ, because I had just kind of the week before said that, like, Pulisic leaving, I don't know. Like if that's an immediate cure-all to whatever the problems are, because you want him to go to some other club of that caliber, and he may be going somewhere else where it's also hard for him to break through and be in a, you know, an every game starter.
That's a point too. I think Mark Pulisic could be well advised to think about that one.
Anything else?
This was on r/caughtoffsidepod, where you can join. I urge everyone to go and join the animals. r/caughtoffsidepod. This is from Tar Heel Texan. JJ's cavalcade of music. Who else likes it when JJ brings up bands he likes and shows he's gone to? I'm listening to Fontaine's DC right now because of him mentioning having gone to their show last week. I think we need a regular segment on the pod where he talks about music.
Oh,
or
my
have
God,
him
this is the most self-serving comment for you to
but
read.
This is funny. There's funny stuff coming at your expense. Or have him and Andrew do a Desert Island Discs list. That'd be fun. I also wonder what side JJ falls on, Stone Roses or Charlatans. My assessment of him as a person depends on the answer. I fall on the Stone Roses side, but that's not to say the Charlatans weren't good. Dennis says, Andrew's Desert Island Discs is entirely Guster.
I mean,
that's true.
Now it is. There was a time in my life where my music taste was everywhere. When I was, you and I were talking about this, when I was in high school, I would just like hear a song and just go buy the CD.
Yeah,
like I've got, like at home, I've got like Eagle Eye Cherry CDs and
Save Tonight,
Semisonic and Stroke Nine.
Closing Time.
Like I would just like One Hit Wonder Sponge, like One Hit Wonder albums everywhere. Vertical Horizon, like crazy stuff. But yeah, I mean, I have my core groups that I loved all the time. Like Weezer was probably the first band that I loved. Was the first, the Blue Album was the first CD I ever owned.
Yeah,
that and Dookie
good.
From Green Day. But I was always more of a Weezer guy.
Zed Paris says, JJ has a love of instrumental post-rock, and for that he is good people. And I think it was my love of instrumental post-rock that killed the Critics Corner. Because we used to have this segment where Andrew gave me free rein to bring in any kind of cultural, musical, cinematic, football related.
I mean, it was supposed to be tethered to soccer, but JJ took
it as a
moment.
But it got untethered quickly.
Yeah, and it was before, like, we knew each other really well, but it was before I really knew just how smug you were. And so when it spiraled into just sort of, you know, this kind of, self-satisfaction. Let me show all of you how smart I am. We had to kill it. Yeah.
No, what killed it was I was like listening to...
Let me tell you all that I read War and Peace last weekend, and if you don't read it this weekend, then I want you to stop listening to this podcast.
Push his glasses to Bridge of Nose. No, I started imposing like... I think the last one I did was a band called This Will Destroy You from Texas. We were like a post-rock band, and you were like, this is, we're not doing this
anymore. What are we even doing anymore?
Yeah, this is dreadful. I think that's pretty much it, except to mention, friends, today, so this is going to age quickly, second legs, big day for West Ham United. They need a West Ham remontada as they travel to Frankfurt for their second game against Eintracht. They are 2-1 down from the first leg. And Glasgow Rangers go in pretty good shape back to Ibrox with a 1-0 deficit, late goal in that tie against RB Leipzig.
And Gabby Agbonlahor will be gathering up all the Celtic fans he can find to cheer on Rangers.
I was in a Glasgow Celtic bar cheering for Rangers, you know, the British team. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. I have one quick one for you before we get out, JJ. I don't know if you saw, but Maradona's, the jersey he was wearing when he scored the Hand of God. So it sold for $9.3 million, which is, it's just, I don't even know what to say about that price tag for a shirt, but okay, fine. But in the spirit of that, like, obviously that jersey is a cool piece of soccer memorabilia. What, if you had unlimited funds, what would be, and you could choose anything.
Oh, this is off.
And you could choose anything. Like, what's the soccer memorabilia that you would want?
Oh, my God.
I was thinking, like, the boot Cantona was wearing when he kicked that guy. Like, what a thing to have.
That is a good one. Oh, that's a good one. Oh, wow. Oh, jerseys, I think, would be... would be the one for me. That's a tough one. I suppose. Yeah, there's so many. Just like off the top of my head, I'm thinking Gascoigne's jersey that he wiped, is the infamous crying picture of him at the World Cup semi-final 1990. One of my first soccer memories. That would be so cool. I would love Zidane's jersey from the 2006 World Cup final. I would love that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That would be an amazing one.
Or Materazzi's. Maybe you can see the head print.
Ronaldo. The original and best Ronaldo, by the way. Original Ronaldo's boots from where he had the R9s, where he had the seizure in the World Cup final and still was included in the team. By the way, fair play to going back to Steve Hodge for keeping that jersey, the England midfielder, because, you know, he's had that forever. Someone said that they saw Steve Hodge bring that. By the way, Hodge played for Forest, Leeds, Aston Villa and Tottenham. That he was on some show, radio station, and a producer said years ago, I saw Steve Hodge bring that jersey into a studio to show someone in a plastic shopping bag. And that thing is going for seven. That's made him 7 million. And Steve Hodge played when, I mean, wages were much, much smaller. So he's just got 7 million windfall at 59 years of age.
What about Allardyce's pint?
Oh, yeah.
That's
that
a good piece of memorabilia.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We'll think on this.
Yeah. Sven-Göran Eriksson's glasses.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe the animals. Send us your responses, because on next week's podcast, of course, we'll recap a huge Caught Offside Cup, but among other things. But yeah, send us some of your responses as well, because I'm sure there's some great pieces of soccer memorabilia that we're just not thinking of. JJ, this was what a show this was. We got a Champions League final for the ages, Liverpool and Real Madrid in Paris. Congratulations to the Sounders as well for the CONCACAF Champions League final. We'll see them in the FIFA Club World Cup, but they actually still have a season to play, so they can't get too excited. It's funny, like they now have a game against like Dallas, I think, this Saturday or something. It's like right back at it, boys. No rest for the weary. Hey.
Back into the grind.
Good stuff, my friend. To you, I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
I'll see you later.
Take care, man.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.